Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Speakeasy. I'm Kate Laity, and here is Valerie Polishar.
Good morning.
Or afternoon.
Before we get started, I want to mention that I've just finished reading Kate's book, White Rabbit. I want to give a little plug for that.
Oh, thank you.
And I think you'll find it quite a romp, kick in the pants, and a lot of great references in there. I was amused all the way through it. Everything from the fall lyrics book to Emily Dickinson pops its head up. So I definitely want to recommend that. I'm going to start by asking Kate some questions, and she'll probably turn those around on me in a little while. I think both of us have a multitude of artistic and creative activities. So I'm just going to start by asking Kate to list all of the activities in that area that she's involved in. Might go over our half hour.
Oh, yeah, let me take a bit of time. Well, I primarily think of myself as a writer, but I'm also a teacher. I write lots of different kinds of things. But I also got interested in things like music, which I've kind of always been interested in and not really pursued because I thought I really sucked at it. And now I'm just kind of like, but I've always done it and I've always really, really enjoyed it. And now I'm kind of old enough to say, I don't care if I suck at it, I enjoy it. And so I've been doing a little bit more
of that. The blessing of getting a little older.
What's that?
The blessing of getting a little older. I understand
that. As you start to realize how much time has slipped by, you start to say, well, I'm not wasting any more of it. And so you do the things that you enjoy, even if, you know, people kind of sneer at you, which, I mean, people who are interested in the arts and who are really trying to express themselves tend to mind a little too much. There's a great Virginia Woolf quote about that, which, of course, I can't quite remember correctly, but about minding far too much about what people think about what they're doing instead of just doing it. And especially in recent years, I've just like taken the William Blake thing on board as just create and assume you're divinely inspired, and the fact that nobody pays any attention to what you do is no valid. It should have no effect on what you're actually doing. You should just do it anyway.
Absolutely.
Even if, you know, you don't really believe you're divinely inspired, but it doesn't matter because it's like, hey, you know, I'm having fun. And if nobody else does, that's their problem.
I kind of feel like it increases the creative entropy in the universe or something.
To do it or not to do it?
To do it. I mean, I think, you know, just pushing it out there. And I also think that you stumble over what you're good at that way, too.
Well, that's true, too, because, I mean, I White Rabbit is one of those weird kind of things where it's a mashup of lots of different things that I'm interested in. You know, from the title, obviously, riffing on Alice in Wonderland, which has been one of those touchstones that's lasted pretty much all my life. But also crime writing, which is fairly recent to me, too, even though, you know, I kind of look back and go, yeah, I was always kind of interested in that and clearly interested in a certain vein of it because I really like noir. But, I mean, I would never have gotten into doing it if it hadn't been. And this is the dedication in that book is to my friend Paul Brazel, who the dedication is he lured me into crime like a stranger with candy. But it's true because I hadn't really thought about it. And he was writing the series that he does with Roman Dalton and said, oh, would you want to write a Roman Dalton story? And I was like, oh, yeah, that'd be so much fun. And then from that, I was like, going, hey, this crime stuff is kind of fun. And at the time, I think that was about when I moved to Ireland. And I was also reading Ken Brune, who is just so marvelous. And
amazing.
On Facebook the other day, he was complaining about, you know, sort of Galway that they don't really appreciate him. And it's like, well, yeah, you kind of have to leave where you are, I think, to get that sort of appreciation, because, you know, it's the Cassandra thing, you know, nobody listens to the prophet in their hometown. And the as dark as his books are, they were really just magic to be reading in Galway and sort of leading me through Galway and all these wonderful places in it. And it's it just kind of mushroomed from there, and I started writing things and going, I should write in this kind of vein. And the first few stories I wrote were actually set in Galway. But then they started moving out, and by far most of them are set in Britain, really. Although I've been writing a few American settings, mostly all the crime writing just seems to want to be over back on the other side, not here, because I'm in New York at the moment. It's weird, but I mean, what's that?
It's interesting, and it also sounds like you kind of fell down a rabbit hole of your own there, following all this, these links to crime fiction.
Well, and I mean,
so tell me, you're on two continents, so tell me where's home, and maybe that affects where you write what.
home is an odd concept, because. Mm-hmm. The place I was born, I haven't been back to in years, and I don't really, I mean, I haven't, I was so desperate to leave it when I was younger that once I did, I didn't feel much, I know a lot of people get nostalgic about their hometown, and my older brother still lives there, but he's the only member of my immediate family who does, and on the occasions that I have visited it, I've felt no pull of nostalgia, saying, "Oh, I want to go back to home." I just keep moving forward. And I mean, one of the interesting aspects of the internet age, of course, is that you meet people from all over. And so when you meet someone and fall for them, and they end up being on a different continent, you either I think the paltry person gives up, and the more courageous person says, "I'm going to charge ahead and go with this." So my job is in one country, and my relationship and new family are all in another. So I go back and forth a lot between New York and Scotland, which is great.
So tell me, what is your day job then, and what's your relationship with your career? Because that's challenging to have one in each continent.
It is. And I mean, I think I sort of ended up in academia by backing away from things I didn't want to do, which for a long time, I think is my standard sort of operating system. It's funny because we were talking about this in the Speakeasy has a private group on Facebook, and we were talking about sort of creativity and having models, because Carol Borden, who was our first interviewee, just lost her mother this weekend, which is very sad. But she spoke very movingly about how her mother was an artist and was struggling to be taken seriously, but how that offered her a model as this is how you can live a life. And mm-hmm. That kind of thing is important. So for me, ending up in academia has been sort of figuring out how to do the things I wanted to do and still survive, you know, economically. Because I think the only people who get romantic ideas about starving artists are people who have, you know, wealthy families and can always go back to them.
Right.
But if you have to, you know, I don't think I could create without knowing the bills are paid. So that's an important thing. And so it was always sort of finding, okay, well, I kind of stuck close to academia even when I wasn't a student, because I sort of felt like, well, this feels like the place where I can be comfortable, because, you know, I've worked in regular jobs too, and I think there's a lot more latitude in academia in general, even if you're not in academia itself. in the support
no,
staff.
No, I absolutely
and,
agree. Absolutely agree.
You know, and so
it's kind
I
of
think
a comfort
that,
zone.
Well, yeah, and I mean that you're even if you're not actively a student, that you're working for a structure that is promoting the idea of learning and expanding and creating new things. And so I think there was always an appeal in that. And I always kind of, when I was drifting around in different academic jobs, I always kind of had the feel that I would go back and study. I just kind of lost momentum because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I've ended up being, you know, a tenured English professor without ever once being an English major, which
well,
I think is
interesting. So what is your educational background?
Well, I got a bachelor's at Michigan State University, and my major was actually James Madison College, which was a college within the university that was sort of a liberal arts kind of thing. My main track of study was international relations, which, you know, people would always ask me, what is that? And I was like, oh, I don't really know. I just study lots of things about different countries and sort of how they interact. And so wanting to get as far from my hometown as I could, and I went to grad school for the first time in Los Angeles to study international relations as a master's. And I think within the first semester, I thought, you know, I'm not so sure this is a good idea, but having been taught to stick to things until you finish them, I did finish it. And then I had absolutely no idea what I would do. And most of the people I knew who were graduating were taking jobs at the State Department. And so I was like, well, I could try that. You know, at least I would get free travel. And so I went through the process, and much to my surprise at every sort of testing level that I got through to the next level and thought, oh, dear.
This is getting serious.
Yeah, and so it's like, oh, I've probably got a file in the FBI on me because, you know, when it came to the point, I finally decided, no, I couldn't really do this because mostly there was a thing you had to sign. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff in the application forms and all that, but there was a thing you had to sign that said, I will uphold in public and in private all policies of this administration and any future administration regarding personal feelings. And
that's a little hard to get past.
Yeah, that was kind of it. So I took a job at the university just kind of as a stopgap and eventually decided, well, I was tired of Los Angeles, so I moved to Boston. And when I got to Boston, I eventually got a job at the Harvard School of Public Health and then the Harvard School of Medicine and started, you know, using my employee perks to take classes and eventually ended up, you know, I ended up in a class where I read Beowulf and Njal Saga, and then I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to read this stuff. And so, you know, I went off and got a PhD. So
that's a fantastic adventure. I'm also amused. I started out in Los Angeles and went to Michigan. So we've crossed some paths somewhere along the way.
What did you study in Michigan?
Oh, I that was when I was a child. So I'm amused. Oh. It seems like everyone's been. I have this theory that everyone's passed through Ann Arbor at some point in their life. And I haven't found too many people that haven't actually been through there. You were in, I guess, Lansing. But so my next question perhaps is a little hard to answer given all this adventuring. But what did you think you were going to be doing with your life when you were, say, 20? And you know, how does it differ?
I had not the faintest idea, really. I mean, for a long time, I think when I was like about 11, I got the first two of the James Harriet books. And from that time, I was like going, oh, I want to be a veterinarian. I want to be a veterinarian. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. I studied science and MSU has a really good veterinary school. So I went along to see some things there. And I thought up until just about the time that I finally went to college, when I decided, you know, what I really liked was the books. and reading about them and what I really wanted to do. And I mean, I kind of knew this, but what I really wanted was to be a writer. And so for a moment, I think I had entered at least on some of the paperwork journalism as a major, not English. I don't know why, but I always avoided English. But then finally, when I actually went to Michigan State, I just had no major declared. I didn't declare a major because I was just like, I was curious about all kinds of things. I didn't know anybody who'd been to college, so I didn't know how.
Oh, so yeah, you didn't have a model for it. That's really interesting.
Well, and I mean, as we were talking about earlier on in the Facebook group, I didn't, when I was really little, I thought all writers were dead. I don't know where I got that idea, but so I didn't know, like, people actually did things like that now, or, you know, then as now.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was kind of weird.
That's what having no model thing. It's really interesting.
You have to kind of form
your own.
Yeah, and I mean, did you grow up with models? Did you grow up with people who'd been to college?
I did. Because my father was a physicist at University of Michigan, and so from childhood it was assumed that I would get a PhD. In fact, it was assumed that my siblings would, which turned out to be a lot of maybe unhelpful pressure on them, but not intentionally so. But so I did have those models. I had models for creativity in some of my aunts and uncles. So I had that floating around in that tier of my life, and I think it does make a difference. But you know, you can end up in the same place. Just a different journey. So I guess
that's
probably the point where we swap hands.
How quickly our time's going up. What's that?
I was just going to say we should probably switch now and have you ask me the same question.
How would you define yourself as a creative? Or how would you list as your qualities, your work?
Yeah, it's very hard for me to put a finger on it. I create music as Huge Shark, and I've even within the music that I create, I'm all over the map genre-wise. I've kind of done everything from kind of the singer-songwriter with a piano to electropop, collaborations in rock and blues, and I had a long-time folk gig at a local cafe in the 80s, so all kinds of areas. And I've written about 400 songs. Also a writer, for sure,
wow.
Mostly short stories. Mostly crime fiction, science fiction, and surrealism. It's starting to all get stirred with a fork, as you're experiencing it as well. The mixed genre is really very freeing, right? You can just do anything. And originally I wrote a lot of poetry. I think I mostly quit publishing that. That was kind of something of my 20s that sort of fizzled out. Maybe that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah,
I also edit a
poetry. For a while.
I also edit a poetry and fiction journal, which I've done for the last 13 years. I have a lot of, you know, creative hobbies. You know, I sketch. I like to draw mazes. It's kind of an odd fact about me. I am always knitting something. I have gone through jewelry making, photography, candle making, soap making, lamp working, Pyrex glass. I've done stained glass. And none of those has really stuck for me. I think as a visual artist, I'm just a B student, and I will always be a B student. So I think I kind of come back to focus on writing and singing as being the primary modes of expression.
And what singers have inspired you as kind of, you know, that you look back on and say, that was where I really got the itch to do this?
You know, I can remember swinging on a swing set when I was about 6 on the kindergarten playground. I was already, I think it was in first grade, and I went back to the kindergarten playground because they had better swings, and singing, making a song up while I was swinging on the swing. And I have found that I wrote and illustrated and bound books starting from about age 7. So I have a whole bunch of these little stories that I wrote. So they're so early that I think, and they're, it wasn't really creative writing around me very immediately in my family. So it's very hard to find the inspiration. I think it must have just been that I was reading books and I wanted to create them, and I was listening to music and I wanted to reproduce it.
Which is often the way. I mean, I feel fortunate that I grew up in a family that loved music. So there was always music on, and
right.
I was always
yes.
hearing
I
lots
had that
of different
too.
Kinds of music. What's that?
I had that as well. My father was actually a violist in the symphony orchestra in Ann Arbor.
Oh, wow.
So I had those both, but not the writing. I don't know where that came from.
For reading.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming you were an avid reader too, even as a child.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I was the kid in at recess who was sitting in a corner with a book instead of running around.
So. Well, we did a lot of running around too, but I always loved reading, and I have to say one of the most wonderful things was as a child the Scholastic book service that you could get catalogs in school, and they were really, really cheap. I mean,
oh, I remember
like,
that. Man, we would go crazy, absolutely crazy, picking books. But yes, that's absolutely. I still have a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. They were so wonderful. And I mean, I was quickly putting a collection together even as a child, because we didn't have lots of books in the house growing up. I mean, we did have some, and I remember my dad had a lot, like down in his office. So I'd go down and look at the bookshelves, and we had a bunch at our cabin too, that my dad and my grandfather built in northern Michigan, and so we read lots of books there too, and they were quite old. So it's kind of interesting to think about how many of them. I wonder how many of them are still up there. But my
yeah.
brothers probably left them up there, but it's. It was a treat to go down to the big library downtown every once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
That we could have
yeah.
a whole, you know, massive amount of books available to us. That
yeah.
it was
I have,
that it was a treat.
I have sort of similar magic memories of the library.
Libraries
it's
are wonderful.
Kind of funny. I mean, yeah, and yet, you know, as a child. I really thought, I think I would have told you I was going to be a writer or a singer. I thought I was very fixated on those things. And it kind of all went out the window. I think I got a little maybe too pragmatic when I hit high school. And I didn't go that direction. So, you know, I didn't gravitate in my studies or my career. I ended up with an undergraduate degree in cognitive science. I did do a minor in writing, but I don't think I really thought very seriously about it at that time. And I went on to, of all things, I have a PhD in visual psychophysics, which is effectively the study of visual illusions and how they are processed in the neurological centers in the brain.
Oh, wow.
And so really
cool.
Way out there. I haven't used it at all. so, you know, I thought I was going to become a professor, but I assumed it was going to be in cognitive science or maybe in vision. And I didn't go that direction either. I ended up I'm in university program administration in IT, actually. I've been for the last 22, 25 something years, I've been a program manager in data networking on campus, and recently added being a program manager for a new technology initiative that's we're kind of trying to serve faculty better with technology. So very much administration with a kind of a geeky IT bent, but really where writing is just a tool of getting, you know, communicating with people. I have to say the ability to write an effective email is very important, but
oh,
absolutely
yeah.
nothing to do with the creative work. So people at work are always very surprised when they find out that, you know, in my free time I'm doing all these other things.
it strikes me as an interesting idea. Have you used things consciously from your studies in your creative work? Because, I mean, I know studying medieval literature really made my writing so much better, if only because I finally realized what I should have learned from Shakespeare is there's nothing original. The only thing that's original is the way you tell an old story. And so, I mean, I've stolen lots of medieval stuff for stories, even stories that weren't necessarily directly medieval. There's a very Lovecraftian story that I stole stuff from my research on Anglo-Saxon poetry and put it in a story, and under one of my other names as Kit Marlowe, or actually as Catherine Marlowe because it's historical. I'm writing a series of novels based on medieval romances, which are more, you know, sort of adventure-based. But
That's fun.
It's coming directly out of my research. I haven't had it
out of the research, but what I did, I did write a novel that was absolutely based on all the people in my graduate department. So, you know, kind of a Romana Clef, but it was a crime novel. So I made the people I didn't like into murderers. It was very exciting to do that. And I think that was mostly purging some long time angst, but the process at the university is so interesting. The way people relate to each other, the way they kind of might hide some of their work. Someone once told me that academia does not necessarily select for people who are great at cooperating or communicating. And you often see this, especially in the older generation of where cooperation and collaboration were not really encouraged. So there's always some strange, almost superstitious behavior on the part of various people that's kind of fun to observe and to write about.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And it's funny because the academic system also, I think it really encourages neuroses because it's all this constant sense of evaluating very nebulous things. But that there's been, especially in the last couple decades, there's been this imposition of the business model on top of education, which only enhances that too, where it's this sense of well, we have to evaluate things, but it's not clearly, like, there's not right answers and wrong answers, but there are clearly better answers and lesser answers. And it's the nebulousness of the hurdles you have to jump over, but also their absolute implacability, which I think can be a really, really difficult thing. Now, of our on-air time, we only have a couple of minutes left, but we can keep talking and it will end up on the podcast. This is what we discovered last time. I wanted to make sure, can you give a couple of places where people can find you online?
Absolutely. Hugeshark.org is a place where you can find my, I better check if that's the right address, find my music. Hugeshark.org. And my writing is a little bit harder to find, but if you go to ValeriePolishar.com, you will be able to find some links to writing pieces there. I'm also on Twitter as Hugeshark. And you?
And me, I'm kalaity.com. I'm also kit-marlowe.com, who also on Facebook, also on Twitter. On SoundCloud, I have two identities. You can find me, I think it's Kate Laity. and I'm on Twitter, of course, as Kate Laity. The Speakeasy, if you're on Facebook, do come by and like Speakeasy Radio. We have lots of things coming up, and we're trying to just bring together as many, you know, cool ideas as we can smash together in as much time as it takes, usually in these 30-minute bites. But we'll see how long it keeps recording after it tells us we're offline, because we just have 30 seconds left. But we'll just keep talking anyway and see how it goes. And when it actually tells us it's no longer recording, then I'll hit end episode.
Sounds good.
If you're listening live, we'll say goodbye for now.
Bye for now.
And if you're listening to the podcast, we'll carry on in just a moment when it clicks over to say the stream has ended. Okay, the stream has ended, but we're still recording, I think.
Interesting. So I actually did want to ask one last question, so we'll see if it shows up on the recording. What would you say is the biggest challenge to your pursuit of your artistic endeavors right now?
Having enough hours in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think having enough hours in the day and having enough energy to do it, too, because, I mean, on teaching days, I don't count on getting much done, but I end up having to sort of shoehorn in things like doing conference abstracts or trying to write a blog post in between classes or during my office hours if nobody shows up, just trying to squeeze in as much as possible. How about you?
It's hard to create in those little pieces of time. I think for my writing, it's definitely the fact that time is chopped up so much. So I wouldn't really say lack of time per se, although that's always an issue. But, you know, you have 15 minutes. Can you get into the mode of writing, write something and be done and be ready to move on without forgetting any of it in 15 minutes? That's always a challenge. But I think for my music, it's really been a lack of privacy. With all due respect to my husband, he's home almost all the time now. And although I can record when he's in the house, I find it difficult to write new songs. For me, it's so personal that even the person I'm closest to, I don't want them listening to my process of creating music, of writing something new. And so I have to wait for the rare occasions when he's not home, and then I have to hope that inspiration is going to strike in that time. I do a lot of songwriting in the car, but it's hard to write all the way through a song without sitting down at an instrument. So, again, maybe that's the squeezing into the little slices kind of problem.
That's the thing. And, I mean, it's well worth trying to figure out a schedule to say, well, you know, if he's home all the time, say, could you take maybe this day and go off and do, you know, something that you want to do outside the house? And we could schedule it that way as a kind of just alerting him to the idea that this would be helpful. Because, I mean, I think that one of the challenges of sharing a house with my brother, as I do here in New York, was sort of figuring out, like, okay, I can't just live life the way that I have been accustomed to doing. I have to take into consideration what his day is like, what his schedule is like. And so once I started thinking about that and sort of saying, okay, well, you know, be more mindful of what the restrictions are. It's like, okay, well, this has been a lot better because I've just shifted my timeline, because I obviously have a much more flexible schedule than my brother, who works the traditional, well, most of the time, traditional hours. He's mm-hmm. been working in development, so he's been having a phone-a-thon the last couple of weeks, so he's been gone a lot more than usual. So, I mean, on the plus side for me, I was like, oh, lots of time where I can sit here in my office and talk to myself. But it is important to have that.
Yeah, I think it certainly, I wouldn't survive without having a study of my own. We learned early on in our relationship that we could not stand, well, I can stand listening to him type, but he can't stand listening to me type, because I type in these odd machine gun bursts that is absolutely disruptive to any thinking. So we decided we needed separate studies, and that's good. That ability to create the space around you that you need to be creative. Is that the whole room of one's own thing, is it has not lost any veracity over the years. I think everybody needs that personal space.
It's really important. And if it's not physical space, that it's, you know, at least a different kind of space. Because, I mean, when I'm in Scotland, my partner, Mark, is so wonderful, because I usually do most of my writing sitting in bed in our bedroom upstairs. And he will, you know, come by and drop off cups of tea to me, and is just totally he's so understanding and so supportive. And I mean, even the kids are really good because they're like, can you play now? And I'm like, oh, I just want to finish. But I mean, in the same way that I've got used to, okay, well, the kids are going to be here, so get your work done ahead of time so you can play.
Right,
and
right.
It is really, you know, unless I have some kind of deadline that I have to do something for, you know, most of the time I try to make sure that the work is done when, you know, in the evening that we like to, you know, watch movies or TV series on television. And so I try to manage my work so that it's the least disruptive to the people that, you know, I live with, which is
right,
good. But I mean,
right.
It's also incredibly important that they understand, you know, this is my work that I need to do.
Right, and Rob's been great about, you know, supporting my writing as well, and also with the cups of tea. Helps to have a fine Australian tea maker as a husband.
Yeah.
And I think also just respecting that I might not want to watch television every night, which, you know, is his way of relaxing, and that I might want to get some writing done. And it's an adjustment, I think, for everybody. That it's really, we all adjust when we're living with somebody else. And I think maybe the ideal for a writer, if you want to just create, is to be by yourself. But I have an overly busy social life, which I'm often complaining about. But I don't think that I could create. I wouldn't have as much to talk about if I didn't have all these interruptions. So I have to kind of credit the interruptions at the same time as I sort of curse them.
It's all material.
Exactly.
Well, I'm not sure if we're recording or not, because it doesn't really say.
This might be a good point to wind it up.
Yeah, we can wind it up. And if it's not being recorded, we already had a wind up. If it is being recorded, then let's repeat. So we're both on Twitter. You're Huge Shark. I'm Kate Leahy. We're both on SoundCloud. You're SoundCloud as Huge Shark. And
I'm
also,
you can find me by searching for Huge Shark on SoundCloud. And also as If This, it's a group that I record with.
Really nice stuff. I've been listening to that too. So it's like, I just love it. That's a Ladies and Gentlemen Preferred Blog. Oh, I just love finding new places where diamonds. I just love finding, you know, new music that I love to listen to, because I'm going to hopefully in a soon-ish be talking with. Oops, I almost lost. I thought it was my computer was going to sleep. Julie Beeman, who is another person.
Oh yeah,
I'm trying to remember exactly
and
how
she does
we found
a great that, tune. Great tune.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really, really, really fun stuff. And it's like, you know, because I have to admit to listening to a lot of, you know, like gloom and doom kind of music in the fall. And Julie writes the most, you know, uplifting, beautiful pop songs, sometimes with a real edge. Bad Band Girlfriend.
I love that one.
But Speakeasy Radio on Facebook, and you're on as yourself on Facebook, personal account, or do you have pages?
There's a page for Huge Shark, which I'm very grateful if people do a like on.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure if I've liked that. I'm going to have to go find it. I have pages also as Graham Wind, my noir name, and Kit Marlowe. And well, I'm responsible for a few things. I do social media stuff for Mavens and Mayhem, which is the Upper Hudson chapter of Sisters in Crime, and for Broad Universe, is a fantastic organization for women in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Don't know about those organizations, you should. Sisters in Crime is a really terrific organization that has chapters everywhere. Well, thanks, Valerie. This is a great chat.
Been a lot of fun. Great to talk to you.
Okay, it was always nice to finally hear the voices that you see online. So now when I see your text, I'll hear it in your voice.
It's a little scary, but yes. Great to talk to you. So I'll hang up now. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye-bye.